Talk Podcast, talking all things Disney, with your hosts, Eljon Go and Dave Bossert.
Welcome to the show. Every week, we talk about all things Disney and pop culture with never-before-heard stories, behind-the-scenes moments from some of your favorite Disney films, theme park attractions, performances, books, music, and so much more. I'm your co-host, and happy, happy New Year. My name's Eljon Go, musician, longtime Disney, Marvel, Star Wars fan, and pop culturist. And you can email me at eljon@skullrockpodcast.com.
And I'm Dave Bossert, artist, filmmaker, author, and welcome to Skull Rock Plus podcast. I'm just going to keep that going. I can't help myself.
Might as well.
If you love Disney and pop culture, please subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform, as well as like and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. We're on all of those platforms. And you can also email me at dave@skullrockpodcast.com. Well, Eljon, I hope you had a good Christmas. I think it was kind of a loud Christmas for you. And I'm glad that you are safe and you and Kristen and the kids are all okay. But you're in Nashville.
Yeah.
And what a wake up call on Christmas morning, huh?
Yeah. So we had this, heard this loud bang. It was very loud. Our neighborhood heard it. My in-laws heard it. It was about 6:30 in the morning. And lo and behold, a whole block and a half, a couple blocks of our downtown Second Avenue district had been, destroyed. And I'm sure everyone has seen footage of that through all the news coverage that it gotten. But wow. So hats off to our first responders and people trying to make sure that our downtown area is safe. And hopefully, that the authorities will get down to the bottom of this whole situation. But wow, not what he expected. And not how we expected to leave 2020 moving into the new year. But, but other than that, yes, we are safe. And we spent the Christmas holiday together as a family. And unfortunately, we do use AT&T, and that service was affected because our AT&T was the primary hub is right there. And so our service was affected. So we had some Zoom and some other calls scheduled, with the family. So we had to postpone all those plans because we couldn't get in touch with everybody. Everything we had was AT&T. So,
yeah, I heard that the cell coverage was down not only in the Nashville area for AT&T, but into parts of Kentucky and sort of the greater Tennessee area.
Yeah.
So that's kind of craziness. Did you feel it at all? Did the house shake or anything? You were far enough away that the house didn't shake.
Right. But the only thing up at 6:30 in the morning here are the roosters and the cows where we are. And so you could hear it. And you're like, what is that? Do you just write it off? You're like, oh, it's just, someone doing something outside or whatever. It's the country in Tennessee, so it could be whatever. But wow, lo and behold, you turn on the news and bam, there it is. And wow, that's all I can say is just wow. And we're very glad that no one else had some, severe injuries or whatever. So like I said, it's just what a way to just, leave 2020 in this really bizarre year that we've had moving into 2021. But, I hope you guys had a good Christmas though, Dave.
Yeah, we did have a good Christmas, but I have to say, Eljon, I was up early on Christmas morning and I was immediately aware of what had happened in Nashville. And I was thinking of you guys, and sent you the note on Facebook. I knew you weren't in the downtown area, so I knew you were pretty safe, but still, really incredible work by the police officers who started to evacuate and wake people in those apartments in the area. And the fact that they're really hasn't been any loss of life from that explosion, other than potentially the person who may have been in the RV. They don't know yet. They're still doing all that investigating. Yeah. But wow. I mean, other than that, it was a really pleasant Christmas weekend, I have to say. Well, it was very relaxed. We watched a lot of Christmas movies. You know, we watched Home Alone as a family. We actually watched some of the Die Hard movies.
You know what? That's the best, right? So not only did you, Kristen and I do watch Home Alone. We watch the Santa Claus. We watch the stuff on Disney Plus. But in terms of non-traditional Christmas movies, yes, Die Hard is on the list. And so is Gremlins. Gremlins is also on the list.
You know? And the National Lampoon Christmas Vacation. Yeah. So
that's right.
But yeah, it was all about just watching some fun movies and just spending time as a family.
Did you catch Soul?
I did not watch that yet. Oh. I will probably have watched it by the time we record our next show.
Okay. Well,
did you watch it?
The wife and I, we saw it last night. Mm-hmm. And let me say, wow. I mean, that's all I can say is wow. So you're going to see
another
a movie.
Pixar hit. Another Pixar
I feel that way because it really is. And this is, you know, puns aside, this movie has soul. It has a heart. And as a musician, I can relate to a lot of the themes, but I think it'll really relate. Everyone can relate to what is it like to live a life that has meaning or purpose, or seeking your meaning and purpose. And I think it will strike a lot of heartstrings and really have people looking at things in a new way. And I know I feel that way, and I struggle with it, you know, looking at this movie and going, how can I live my life better? And it's something that I feel after watching this movie, I really need to take that in and make some adjustments, you know, just because it just causes you to think. And I think that's a really great thing about these type of movies. When Pixar makes these movies as an adult, going into it, looking at it from a child's perspective or just a pure entertainment aspect, I am entertained. I'm very entertained. I love the cinematography and the art behind it, the story, the music, of course. But then when I look and I finish the movie, I sit back and think about these questions that they pose. Wow, that's where I feel like the movie is undeniable. When you can sit back and look at your life and just examine it for what it is and the questions it poses to the viewer. It's amazing. So let me know what you think.
I'm looking forward to seeing it. But hey, talking about soul.
Yes.
Let's talk about an artistic soul that we have coming up as our special guest, Mike Gabriel. I think I got to tell you, he's really one of the most talented artists in the industry that I've worked with over the decades. I mean, he's such a multifaceted artist, and I am really looking forward to not only introducing him to you, but also just pulling some of his stories out, having, you know, he's a great storyteller, and he's going to tell us, I think, some amazing stories, and I'm really looking forward to that. And I almost feel like we should just get to it.
Let's do it.
What do you think?
Yeah,
let's just get to it.
Let's hit the button.
Podcast interview time.
Well, Al John, I got to tell you, we have an incredible guest with us today. I've had the pleasure of working with him for well over 30 years, and I got to tell you, this is a guy who has done it all. I mean, you know, he is one of the most talented people in the animation industry today. He was an animator. He was a director, a creative director, a visual development artist, a production designer, art director. I mean, it just goes on and on. I mean, what this guy has done is, the body of work is incredible. And I will tell our audience today, we will not be able to cover it all. So we're going to talk to Mike Gabriel, our special guest, because he was one of the directors of Rescuers Down Under, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. And by the way, I would also point out that Mike also was the guy who pitched and co-directed Pocahontas, which is also celebrating a 25th anniversary this year. Am I correct on that, Mike?
Yep, that's right.
So, Mike, welcome to our show.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here. I'm excited.
It's fantastic to have you. And it's like I said, you know, we can't possibly cover your entire career because you've just done so much. But what I wanted to start with, and I know our audience is going to love, is how you got hired at Disney. And this is, folks, this is such an incredibly inspiring story that I think most people who are, you know, if you're starting out in the business, you got to listen to this story. Mike, I'm going to turn it over to you because this is a great story.
Well, it is incredible. And now I'm just retiring now. So I'm kind of doing a lot of looking back on my career and how did I ever get to Disney in the first place? And what was my beginning? Did my dream really come true? Did I really do it? Or was it all just some sort of a strange dream? But because I was one of those little guys at 5 years old, I had seen Pinocchio in the theater, and I just was swept up in the whole Disney look and feel and the magic of animation. And so, believe it or not, 5 years old, I decided, I told my mom, and I remember telling my mom, I want to be a Disney artist. And she described to me when I was that young how, well, they all draw the character and it's all from different angles. And so you got to really learn. And I'm thinking, you mean there are a lot of guys that draw that well and they can draw Pinocchio from all those different angles? So I just got swept up in the concept of how in the hell can anyone be that talented? So I just set my little laser beam at 5 years old. That's what I'm going to do. I was living in Salina, Kansas. My dad was stationed there in an Air Force base, Schilling Air Force Base. So I'm in the middle of the country, Kansas, although in hindsight, it's kind of Walt Disney country, that Midwest, you know, next to Missouri and Kansas City, and not far from where Walt grew up, actually. Maybe that's why my sensibility is always sort of linked in pretty closely. People always said, no, you've kind of got the Disney, you know, sort of feeling to your stuff. But anyway, I wanted to get to Disney. So all through my grammar school years, I was always the artist in the class, and I want to work at Disney. So that was my dream, to get into Disney. About high school years, I think I was about 15 or 16, my early high school years, I started writing to the studio. We had since, my dad had retired from the Air Force, and we moved to Huntington Beach, California, which is, you know, a good hour and a half, 2 hour commute drive to the studio where Walt Disney Studios was. It's not a Disneyland. And so I just started writing to the studio, asking them, sending my little drawings. I would cut out these cartoon characters and tape them on a sheet and Xerox them and send them to the studio. And those beautiful orangey yellow envelopes would come back with Mickey on the envelope that said Walt Disney Studios. They're going to love my stuff. They're going to want me to work for them. And I'm like 16 at the time. And I opened the envelope and they just had this nice little short letter. Thank you, Mike, for writing. Very nice, but just saying you need to keep doing anatomy drawings, draw from real life. Don't do cartoons. Don't send us cartoons. We'll teach you that when you get here. So so disappointed. And I was like, just crestfallen. But I'd worked for another year, maybe doing my anatomy drawings and trying to do what they wanted. And then I would cut out more cartoon drawings and send them cartoon drawings when I'm 17, 18. Every time I would send them the sort of my new art, it was Ed Hansen was the guy sending it back. And he would send it back and say, Mike, just remember, you've got to learn the basics, learn how to draw human anatomy, animal anatomy. So you can't don't worry about the cartoon stuff. Stop sending the cartoon stuff. We're going to start up CalArts soon. So we want you to, you know, consider that. That's a great place to learn to start your entry into the studio. So anyway, all I ever heard was sort of blah, 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 blah. Till about the fourth time I wrote and they sent back the same thing saying, learn to draw. I just said, okay, I'm never getting in unless I learn. I'm going to do what they keep telling me to do. So I went to the school library. Actually, it was the city library, and stacked up all the art books in the art department, at least the major anatomy ones, you know, Bernd Hogarth or Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, any of the famous, you know, just great anatomy artists. And I'm telling you, it was a stack on my desk that high. And I took every book from the top and just went page by page and drew it. And I drew it and I just drew every page. And I mean, if it was an arm being dissected with the muscle, I would draw that. And the hand, every hand drawing that Da Vinci or Hogarth or, believe it or not, the Muybridge books, if anyone knows the action analysis books, where every pose of every human or a child, an adult, a woman, an elder, or a horse or a goat, anything that's moving, he would capture those frames of just one slight little leg difference in each shot. Well, I drew every single frame of every single book that he did. And I just was going to keep doing that and draw. I would even take every magazine that came in the house, Time Magazine, and I would draw the hand on every photo, just draw that hand. So I committed to drawing my brains out for 6 hours a day. My parents will tell you, 6 hours a day, I was up in my room. I had made a huge desk and I shellacked it when I was a surfer from Huntington Beach. So I took my resin and shellacked this big desk and I would draw on that desk all day long. And I just was determined. So I saw Small One came out. And when I saw Small One came out, I just thought, I don't care. I think I'm good enough to get in. I think I can make it now. So at the time I was doing these airline the safety cards where it's just those fold out plastic flaps, but it has little red arrows and people grabbing a red handle and cranking it and stuff like that. That was my job, to paint the cells with the little red arrow. And so, and it was menial labor, but you know, I just was sitting there and I saw the pamphlet that said, they're looking for artists again. I go, well, I'm going to call up. So I called up and said, I think I'm ready. I'd like to come in for an interview. I think I've got what you're looking for. And the guy that you go see is called Donald Duckwall, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. So you go meet Donald Duckwall at Disney Studios. And of course, everybody in my family, I have 10 siblings, everyone in my family, I was like John Boy Walton, you know, wanted to be a writer. So I'm John Boy Walton finally gets his shot at going to Disney Studios after probably another 4 years. So I was around 20, at that time I was 23 years old. So I've been doing it for 4 years, you know, after high school, just hitting those art books. And now I've got my portfolio. I bought a big, huge portfolio, put on the coat and tie. It's about 120 degrees in the valley out here. So I go to the big city, LA, and across the valley, and I go to the studio, and, you know, I can almost hear a choir of angels as I walk into the gate, you know, and there's the animation building. And here I'm carrying my artwork I've worked so hard on, and all these art sketch pads of Muybridge, you know, 500 little horses and a bird flapping and all this stuff. So I'm coming in with my artwork and I could just hear the laughter in the hallways. I could hear the artists, these young voices kind of laughing and horsing around, and I'm just the shiny floors. And I'm like, you could just smell the talent in this building, the famous animation building, Walt Disney Studios. So, and I'm going up to see Donald Duckwall, and just, this is the dream, baby. This is the dream. So I went into his office on the second floor. And nice guy, you know, typical you'd expect from a Disney. He was like right off a Disney set, but with the little cardigan sweater and kind of handsome young elder guy with gray hair. And he just came in. Yeah, let me take a look, Mike. Let me look at your stuff. So zoop, took out my artwork, started going through it. And he noticed, yeah, I had some talent and I had some paintings I had done. And he said, wow, boy, maybe you want to be in the background department, son. I go, no, sir. I really want to be an animator. I want to be an animator. So goes, well, what you want to do is get some silhouettes, you know, better, clear silhouettes of action that you really read the pose. And he starts describing what they like in an animator sketch pad, you know, what they're looking for. So, and this is about half an hour into the meeting, and I just start to melt because I realize he's saying, Now, when you submit your next art, when you come in, I'm just going, I'm not in. I can't believe this. I've killed myself for 5 years. I've got, you know, these amazing, at least determination, if not talent in the art. So anyway, he just said, well, you go try to capture some action in your poses, get some motion in your drawings and really feel the motion. Why, you know, go draw from real life. And we really can't show art drawn from books, you know. So you've gotten these Da Vinci drawings and Rodin, all that. We can't really show that to our review board. So keep trying and we'll see. So I remember stopping at his door, at his office door. I was so disappointed, but I said, I'm going to give you what you're looking for. And he goes, I know you will, son. I know you will. Come, you know, sure, you bet. So that night, I went home, and believe me, I had to face everybody just going, you're in. And I go, not in. Did not get in. No, it was horrifying. So they all knew what it meant to me. And so that weekend, that was on a Friday, that weekend, I just did everything that Don Duckwell told me to do, to get the silhouette, watch golfers on the golf, capture the swing of a golf club, I went to the beach, got my brothers throwing frisbee, jumping, leaping, just trying to get the essence of motion in the drawings. I even ran around a basketball court that night with my brother, Tom. He was young, little Tom and Bob, actually two brothers. And as they're making the moves, I'm running with them, trying to capture that action, the action, the feeling of motion. So I just drew that whole weekend, and just on a little pad, you know, I had this giant portfolio for my first thing. Now I've got a little pad of these sketches that I'm doing as I'm running around. So I just sent in these little things of sketches, a little packet really of my loose sketches, sent them in on Monday. So had the interview on Friday, drew on the weekend, and sent the new drawings in on Monday. So, okay, I'm waiting. It's Tuesday. Haven't heard anything. Well, not sure they would have gotten there by then. Wednesday, nothing. Okay. Thursday, this isn't good. I think I would have heard at least if they liked him by Thursday. So Friday, I'm believing deep down, kind of shy and not too pushy. So I even let Friday come around and just go, well, I hate to kind of be annoying. I don't want a nuisance, right? So I called up Ed Hansen and said, Ed, I sent some drawings in on Monday. I haven't heard back. He's like, Mike, we've all been looking for you. We love your new sketches. That's exactly what we were looking for. We showed it to the nine old men and Glenn Keane's there, and they loved your sketches. So you're going to be starting. We want you to start in 2 weeks with Eric Larson being your mentor, and you're going to come in and you're going to, I'm like, From zero to 100, I was.
From zero to a hero.
Zero to hero.
Oh, my God. I've never felt a greater relation. And I went running down to my parents, and my dad was in the kitchen. And I said, I got it. I'm in. And he gave me an actual slap on the back. He said, great, Mike. I'm so happy for you. It was like the pat on the back from your dad.
Now, the one thing I want to mention to the audience here, you didn't go to art school.
No.
You are self-taught. Wow. You never went to college.
And believe it or not, I was so stupid. I was given the pamphlet. The studio did mail me eventually, you know, because I've been annoying them for 4 years, and they did eventually mail me the pamphlet to CalArts when it was the first year. I would have started with Lasseter and John Musker and, you know, Gary Reese and the first Henry Selick, and Tim Burton was the next year. But I would have been starting with this bunch of, you know, supreme talents of the animation industry. So I would have grown better. I would have gotten, you know, gone further, I think. But anyway, I didn't want to go to college. I wanted to go to Disney Studios. So sure. I can be very, as Dave knows, I can be somewhat creatively stubborn, and I just was going to do it my way. I'll do it my way. I'll learn myself. So that's why I got the books. That's why I'll do it with I don't need an instructor to tell me. So I'm passing up the opportunity to work with Bill Moore, you know, and TV and great Disney.
Elmer Plummer. Yeah.
Plummer.
Ken O'Connor.
And all those guys that went to CalArts, just new stuff. When I went to the studio and I quickly bonded with them, they all took me under their wing, and I just kind of became a pal quick with them. And I just could see they had stuff in their head that they learned from those masters that I had to pick up from them.
So yeah, but I'll tell you though, you probably learned it all in 6 months at the Disney Studios.
I did.
Tell people is that, you know, you can spend 3 or 4 years in art school.
That's true.
When you get into a studio setting, you learn more in 6 months or a year than you did the entire time you were at art school.
Because just look at the caliber of artist you're working with alongside. I mean, you're there, and you're a fan, so you're loving what they're doing. And you want to be able to do what they're doing. Yeah, all my 41 years at the studio, I was always, that was the best part of the job, is looking at the art that the guy in the room next to, or the girl, Brittany Lee, and now Lorelei, and you know.
What a proving ground for you. And not only that, I mean, you got to work with, at least the 9 old men that were still around, and you had Eric Larson to be your mentor. I mean, what was that like?
Oh, it was just, it was beyond perfection as far as what you would hope it would be like as going into Disney, the warmth, you know, of the man, the class, the elegance, the demeanor, and the kindness, and this, you know, just... He makes Walt Disney look like an ogre. That's how sweet he was.
Yeah.
That's really good to hear. Yeah.
And he was one of the last ones working, one of the last 9 old men who was actually working at the studio.
Yeah, he was.
Because the rest of the guys, I mean, John Lounsbery had passed away in the early 70s. And then you had Frank and Ollie were starting to write books and were sort of drifting into retirement, if you will. You know,
a few lectures from Frank and Ollie, and certainly a lot from Eric. And Eric was in the room right next to me, Al John. So I would come in the morning, and because I was commuting from Huntington Beach for the first 6 months, so I would get on the road at 4:30-ish in the morning and get to the studio right before the sun is breaking the horizon. I'd be the first guy in the building. Of course, I was that excited to be doing this. And I wanted to make sure you had to do a test for the first month and a test on the second month. And those tests had to tell the review board that you had enough talent to stay. So you weren't fully in until that second month. But in my mind, and it seemed like everything was going well, so I never really was too freaked about that test getting a pass.
It was a probationary period.
It was a little bit of a probation. But there's Eric right in the room next to you. You just go in, and you know, he's got the great Disney director desk, all this stuff that Dave knows so well.
Which, by the way, I would point out that you have right behind you.
That's awesome.
I love it. The director's desk. I love the desk.
The director's desk. Okay.
Yeah. And
I've got the animation desk over here.
That's fantastic. So this is what, 1980?
This is 1980. Yeah, 79 really when I got in. And I started October 1st, 1979.
Now,
the end of the 70s.
When did they actually put you onto production?
After the first two tests, Dave Block, animator, he was an animator there, and he requested me for an in-betweener as to be his rough in-betweener. So I went right on to Fox and the Hound and started doing in-betweens for Dave, and really just having to learn. And Walt Stanchfield would teach in-betweening to the young people like me. So we would take some of Milt's animation from Aristocats, the old guy with the top hat and the cane. Mm-hmm. I still remember him tapping the top of his hat with his cane and that great face, doing his overlap on the old man's hair, you know, and learning how you reverse that and make it flow. So you learn as you were there, but it was basically in between for Dave Block. And then Dave started giving me little details to do. And he quickly started giving me little bits of animation, like the fox, when they were little. No, it was the little puppy. What's his dog's name?
Copper.
Yeah,
Copper.
Yeah. I've been in about 60 movies under my belt, so I can't lose the names. But Copper was running around the yard. He's tied up to a barrel, so he had a little rope tied around his neck. So Dave did the little puppy running around the yard, and I just had to animate the rope that's tied up to it to make it look legit, like it really had slack and all that, get taut and slack. But Dave, I remember he saw what I did and he just said, hey, that's great, staying in the movie. So that was my first animation.
Fantastic.
In Fox and the Hound, my first real fun animation was the bear fight. Musker and, of course, Glenn Keane was, and Lasseter had boarded it with him. So anyway, those top talents were working on this bear fight and they asked me to come up with ideas for the scene. So I came up with the idea of the fox sliding backwards on the rocks as he's trying to scramble up a crusty little ridge. And then he slides backwards right under the bear and goes right under the bear's belly. And so anyway, I got to, not only I gave him the idea for doing that, and they said, yeah, why don't you animate it too? So that was my first.
That's awesome.
And I have the fox turning and looking with that, you know, going into the shadow, looking at the bear. So that's still part of my heritage.
Now you were there working on Fox and the Hound, and right around that time, the whole Bluth crew left.
Yeah, I always quickly say, hey, no, they didn't hire me because they needed anybody at that point. I was hired before they walked.
Right.
So I was 2 weeks before, I was like hired and I was going to start in 2 weeks. A week after I got hired, they all walked. So when I came in to start work, yeah, it was like days. It had only been like 4 days since everybody walked out. Yeah, the Don Bluth group. So I never met any of them, and you know, never really was a part of that.
But you were in the thick of all the commotion because of it, right? The wake of them leaving, and there was some rumors flying.
They were hoping anyone that showed enough talent would elevate rather quickly. But honestly, I was. Even in that circumstance, it took me years to become an animator. I became an assistant animator, animating assistant. You just stack up. I started doing little odd things, you know, different unique little properties like
Fun
with Mr. Future and the titles to Condor Man. I got to animate a lot of those with Mike Cedeno. So I had fun, you know, doing little bits, but those didn't count as legit feature animation. So even though I stacked up hundreds of feet of animation, I still wasn't getting promoted.
But you were getting the experience, and that's really what matters about it all.
Those are some of my greatest memories of my career.
Yeah.
Is from those early years with all those young guys, and we're just learning everything. And when they
came into your room, you just said yes.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, it's like, hey, you want to work on this? Okay. Yeah, sure. You know, I mean, that happened to me because I started on Black Cauldron. I mean, but it was the same situation.
Oh yeah. Whatever you want. Sure. I'm so happy to be here. But even they would come in with these crazy ideas. You remember, Dave, we had newspaper day where one day we were going to pretend because we worked next to the tall office building, the Roy O building. And they all had suits on, and we're just young kids, you know, with t-shirts on and jeans. And we're the young, scrappy, scruffy artists. And so we decided we're going to come in suits one day with three-piece suits and ties and everything and, you know, slick down hair and just be them for a day. So we just, I think Musker might have come up with the idea of, yeah, we'll be running competing newspapers. So I'm D-Wing. You'll be the editor of the D-Wing newspaper. I'll be B-Wing. We're the B-Wing newspaper, and we're competing all day long. So all day long, we kept calling each other's office. All right, you bastard, you stole my best line. That headline was mine, you. We smoked all day long. We're just puffing cigarettes. And we even went to the coral room in our suits. And they reserved a table. Somehow somebody reserved a table for us. So we had this long table with like 15 of our crew. And we're all wearing suits and ties, you know, Daryl Vinsitters and Jamo and Chris Buck. And
they're all nervous about it, right?
Yeah.
They got nervous. So,
and then we didn't include Tim Burton. He was, you know, and certainly one of the main pack leaders, but we hadn't included him in the newspaper thing. So he, in the middle of this lunch we're having in the coral room at the studio in our suits and trying and smoking and annoying all the regular people that are eating, you know, the executives, Tim barges in and he's like, he's acting weird. And then he blows like oatmeal all over the table. And he said, come on, hire me back. I'm off the sauce. I promise I'm off the sauce.
Oh, wow. Oh my gosh.
And
that was actually before my time. I don't remember that. That had to have been prior to me getting hired.
All the personalities and fun you missed, Dave.
Yeah. I know that's so fantastic. No, I do. I have to say though, anytime if you came to work with a shirt and tie on, people got nervous. I remember that's doing it a couple of times just as a goof, and people were like, "Hey, what's going on?" You know,
what's up?
There was a few people I would say, oh, you know, I got a court appearance later or something.
Hey, believe it or not, it's like that over there at the music industry as well. Anytime that we would show up in a jacket or a tie or a button down shirt, they're like, are you, what are you doing? Are you being deposed?
Worst mistake I made in my life was going to the Annecy Film Festival. Lorenzo, the short film I directed in 2004.
Yeah.
I, you know, did a lot on it. So I was there nominated for best short. So I don't know why, but we went with Did you go with us, Dave?
No, I didn't go on that trip. No.
Roy's flight, Roy Disney's private jet with Patty and Roy. But anyway, the opening night where they introduced the key filmmakers that are going to be competing in this thing. I don't know why I wore I never been to it before, but I just wore a coat and tie and a suit and tie. I think it was a full suit and tie and white shirt. So when they introduce you, you stand up on stage and everyone's kind of, okay, clap, clap, clap. And from that moment on, they all just thought I was a Disney stooge exec. They really, when I won the award, they just ignored me. They all just thought he was just not really an artist. I got word on this later from one of the guys that was there at the time.
Wow.
Because I met him years later and he said, "You're kidding me. You actually worked on the film?" I go, "I animated, I storyboarded it, I designed it." He goes, "I wish I would have known that. We all thought you were just a Disney exec, you know?"
Honestly, I got to tell
you. And I won the award, you know?
Of course you won the award. I mean, but I have to say, you said earlier, well, you know, I kind of did this film, you know, I worked on this Lorenzo film. No, Mike, you did the entire film. I mean, you literally... production designed it, directed it, storyboarded it, you animated it. I mean, you did the rough animation on it, for crying out.
Certain scenes, yeah.
For a lot of it. You even did the brush strokes that were then mapped onto the CG work that went over the rough animation. I mean, that was, talk about like, it was almost, Al John, I have to tell you, it was almost as if the guy was just working in his garage on an independent short. That's, you know, the rest of us, I was involved with it. I mean, I was just there to help him. I was there just to support the guy and get his artwork up on screen. But I mean, really, that's, you did the entire film. And that's what a lot of people don't really realize.
Yeah, so
there were amazing. Other people there that were involved that helped, but you did that film. Okay.
I finally got to do my, what I call it is, even though I didn't go to CalArts, I always call it my CalArts film.
That's amazing. I love it.
There you go.
Well, before we move on, two questions about Lorenzo, right? So is Lorenzo based on, are you a cat person, animal person? Is this based on a cat that you know or had?
No, it isn't. It's, in fact, I love animating cats and drawing cats, and I love animating dogs and drawing. So cats and dogs are, and mice are my three probably favorite little cartoon characters.
I was going to say, right.
But not in real life. I don't have a, I do have a dog, but I don't have a cat, never have. But it really came from Joe Grant, who was still at he came back to the studio. He and I were very close and worked as partners really for a decade or more. And he had this idea. He would just take his old ideas and pin them on a board outside his office. So it was one of those ideas he had pinned up with this beautiful, big, fluffy blue cat in pastels. And just the little incidents that would happen in a short or a feature, he wasn't sure what could be made out of it. And so he would board, he and Bernie Mattinson, who is sort of a great story sketch artist, who's still there. He's still there.
Yeah, I know. I mean, crazy. Bernie will be the last man.
He will be the last guy.
Yeah.
But they started getting that on its feet. And then Don Hahn started trying to make, and Roy Disney wanted to make a Fantasia.
Well, it was going to be Fantasia 2. It was going to be Fantasia World.
Yeah, with a lot of folk music from around the world. So they tried putting some music to it. So anyway, it didn't get off the ground until Don, when I was available, Don said, "Would you take over or work on would you like to work on this idea or a Kodo drums?" Or he gave me like Polynesian music. He said, he gave me kind of a nice little palette of musical ideas. But I wanted to take the Lorenzo thing. I loved the Lorenzo idea that Joe and Bernie were working on. So I went and I jumped onto that and sort of, Joe, I would always throw everything in front of those guys, especially Joe, and say, "What do you think, Joe?" And he goes, yeah, do this. I found the track and all that stuff.
But we're jumping ahead here.
I'm sorry.
Away, like 20 years ahead on his career, for crying out loud.
Sorry, so, sidetracked
so
everybody.
So you mentioned Fun with Mr. Future, and then you got onto Black Cauldron, right? Now, on Black Cauldron, you were animating at that point, weren't you?
Yeah, I was happy to be on a feature just because I wanted to get the rank of animator just because of the prestige of being a Disney animator. And all the CalArts guys were already animators, and I just wanted to feel like I was at their level, you know, keeping up with the top guys. So anyway, I was happy to be on, and we were all excited about it at the beginning, as you know, the books were inspiring. So yeah, I became an animator. I think I eventually became an animator on Black Cauldron, and I worked with Hendel Butoy a lot. He he would do the Gergi and I would do the Terran, you know, animation scene. So we would split some animation. I got into the witches quite a bit. I have some pretty, you know, fun. They were fun for me. At that time, I started having really fun animating. I would animate little tiny thumbnails and I would really pose it out as a thumbnail and I would flip it and make sure my tiny little thumbnails were working, flipping and posing. And then I would blow them up and Xerox them up to a full scale, just these little rough sketches. But I knew if I stayed on that arc, on those arcs, it was going to be, it would be smooth as hell, which it was. I would then put the drawing into it and it was just like rolling like glass. It was just so smooth because setting it up tiny really made it stay true to the arcs. So anyway, I started having fun doing that stuff.
Handel was the supervising animator for Gergi.
Yeah, he was the supervisor on Gergi. So I did get a few little Gergi scenes and I did a lot of different things. It was a hodgepodge. I was a new young animator, so I got a little piece of this, a little piece of that.
And you needed to do at least 100 feet of animation to get that animator credit.
Yeah, so I finally got it. Yeah.
Awesome. And the film was the film.
And it turned out to be the best film Disney ever made. I was so proud of it.
Hey, listen, it was my first film, and I still have a warm spot in my heart for that movie. I really do. And, in fact, this year is the 35th anniversary of Black Cauldron.
Wow.
Which is craziness, you know. But I will tell you, though, when I finished in the effects department on Black Cauldron, they asked me to paint cells because they wanted to hold on to me, but they didn't have anything for me to do. And I painted cells for like 5 or 6 months. Wow. Best education I ever got.
Yeah, cool.
Best ever on the whole back end of the process. But anyway, you do Black Cauldron and you're an animator and then you move on to Great Mouse Detective, which is now being directed by John Musker, one of your buddies, and Ron Clemens.
Yeah, at the time the studio got Roy Disney manipulated to get new leadership into the studio. So we had a new studio leadership with Michael Eisner and Frank Wells. And that meant we're moving out of the animation building to new warehouse buildings in Glendale. So
you mean we're being kicked off? We're kicked off the studio a lot.
it was a heartbreak to leave our beloved studio, you know, and get moved off to the warehouses. But we did, and we made great films regardless. The first one was The Great Mouse Detective or Basil of Baker Street. And it was just fun because we had our kind of guys. John and Ron were just our you know, they're 5 years longer senior to us at the studio, but these were the kind of our pals. So they were directing, which was really cool. And Bernie Mattinson, and he was such a great guy to work with. So anyway, we just had a playground of fun with Mike. What characters do you want to work on? Oh, the big fat cat and how about the dog? I love dogs. So I got Toby. I got to be the character leader on Toby, the Basset Hound. And it was just, I was cranking out footage all, you know, it was just such a fun period to be in the studio.
You know, I remember during Great Mouse Detective, they had done some audience, some test audiences, and Toby had gotten a lot of good response. So Jeffrey Katzenberg wanted to add more Toby scenes. Do you recall that?
I do remember it. I would start to get a lot of, that's why I got to do some stuff at the end where Toby's chasing the fat cat, you know, through the, to be politically correct, the extra fluffy cat, let's just say, extra furry, a lot of extra fur on that cat.
A little chunky. Body shame that cat, okay? Yeah.
A little chunky. Some of the funnest animation I ever did is the chase, that bag of jelly cat, you know, running. You lock the head in and the whole body is just going void, 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 void. You could do 4-frame cycle. In 4 frames, you got a cat going like that. As long as the head's just doing a little bit of movement. I had so much fun on that film.
So Mike, when did you sort of start to segue out of animation into story?
It was around that time, Little Mermaid was starting to be developed with Alan Menken and Howard Ashman, with John and Ron. They were attached always, you know, it seemed like, because I think it was their pitch, Ron's pitch, in fact. So that was starting to happen. And George Scribner was, Jeffrey Katzenberg was now our creative boss, really. And he wanted to do an Oliver story, you know, but with animals. I forget where the original concept came from, turning it into a cat and dog thing. I forget, but it was already underway. And Roger Allers was the head of story. And he just came up to me one day in the hallway, because I was just an animator. But I guess I had always talked, I have a lot of opinions and a lot of reactions, and at a screening, I'll say a lot afterwards. So,
and ideas, you were throwing out a ideas, lot of ideas.
Yeah. Ideas. So story ideas, really a lot about the characters and the story and the development of what's working. And so anyway, Roger came up to me once and just said, "Hey, Mike, would you be willing to come in and do story sketch for us on Oliver? We'd like you to start doing story." So I just jumped at it and said, "Yeah, that sounds great. I'd love to try it." But it was terrifying to try it. Believe me, if anyone's been a storyboard artist, it takes a lot of guts to get up and pitch a board, and you gotta perform, and and as an animator, you're in your own little private cave, you know, and you're in your office animating. But on story, you're in there and you're pitching and you're pinning up ideas, and then you gotta get up and perform it. You know, Joe Ramp was the greatest, and Vance Gerry, two of the greatest pitch artists ever.
But you're completely exposed.
But you're exposed.
Yeah.
And I really almost, trust me, I'm not kidding when I say this. You think, oh, exaggerating. I'm not. That day I had to pitch my first board, I was so petrified, because I'd been working in there in my office for about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and I had to pitch my first sequence, which was Dodger sneaking in with the sausages around his neck. He sneaking back into his own little house, his own little, that little barge that they're in, and trying not to let the other dogs smell the sausages and Tito's around, and, you know. So anyway, that was the scene, but I had to go in and pitch it, and I was petrified. And as I'm driving on the freeway, my off ramp is coming up, and I'm so close. I just said, "Keep driving. Don't just never go back to the studio. Just drive to the beach and never go back to the studio. And then no one will know any different. You know, I will never have to face that frightening moment. Life will be fine. Just keep driving. Keep driving." And I really, until I came to the off ramp, and I just go, "I'm doing it. I'm doing it." So I got off on the off ramp. I go to this office, and here I've got to pitch it. I expect George Scribner to be in there, the director, who's the nicest guy in the world. I'm frightened to pitch to George Scribner. He's the sweetest guy in the world. But I go into my office, believe it or not, there's like six guys in black suits with ties from the studio. And George says, "Mike, we're going to pitch. I want that." They wanted to see how the film's developing. So they're going to watch me pitch the board. Oh my Lord. So anyway, I still remember getting up there going more terrified than ever. But I started to pitch, and immediately, because it's my board, immediately I just got into the moment, because I pitched. I know what's inside of every character I'm pitching. You know, I know what Dodger's thinking and feeling. So Dodger sneaks in and comes in. Tito pops up. So you just start pitching because you've conceived every bit of the action and the characters. So it was so fun to pitch, and I got a big round of applause, and it was just, you know, it was almost like that's the only time I remember being nervous of a pitch, because I never really was nervous.
First time's always the nervous one, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then afterwards, you're like, "Why was I nervous?" Right?
Exactly. You know?
So
exactly.
That's awesome. Yeah,
first, I always say, because I've presented, I've been a director and production designer, you've had to present so many things. I always say you're only nervous for the first 15 seconds. After that, you can't get off the stage. It's like, shut up and get off the stage. You immediately love that. You're just enjoying it so much, you can't even stop. You know, I could go on all day, man.
But it's somebody like, bring in the hook.
Yeah, you need the hook. Yeah, so I'm doing storyboards, and then I started doing key sequences, the Fagin reading the storybook to the other dogs, or the dogs reading to him, really. And the end, the end subway chase, and oh, Dodger song was my big sequence. I boarded it, and so I got to board that, and then I got to supervise the animation. I would go and record the talent. George Scribner and I would go and record the artists a lot, and in New York, and George didn't really care to fly, and so after a certain point, I had already recorded with George a few times, Billy Joel and, you know, different Joey Lawrence and different actors. So at a certain point, they just let me go alone to New York to record the artists. And so I was doing a lot of sort of almost assistant directing work. I was doing color models with George, you know, keying the colors and character design. Yeah, I was doing character design. Andreas and I did a lot of the character design.
That was a great thing about being able to do little bits and pieces, you know.
Whatever you got inspired to do, or whatever you wanted to put some input in, they would kind of let you do it at that point, because we were just all young guys trying things.
Yeah, I know George does not like to fly. he and I did a project where we had to go to Mexico City and then to Acapulco, and instead of flying to Acapulco, we were driven to Acapulco. Had this road trip across Mexico. It was hilarious. Hilarious. A story for another time.
I can't imagine.
That's my experience with George, who, by the way, we had on like a month ago, talking about what the heck were we talking about?
That's a good question.
It was the anniversary of Prince and the Pauper. That was
That's
it.
Right.
Yeah, there's so many anniversaries this year. It was kind of crazy, you know?
Yep.
So you really got your feet wet on storyboarding on Oliver and Company.
Yeah, and they sometimes I would put sound behind my stuff, and I started to make little sequences and put music cues and things. So anyway, it's at one point they had determined they were going to... Peter Schneider was our boss of the department, and he called me into his office as Oliver and Company was kind of starting to wrap, and he offered me, the Rescuers Down Under, even back then, that was the title from the beginning. So we're going to make a sequel to Rescuers. Would you like to direct it? And I said, well, why would you want to make a sequel to that film? He said, well, that's what we're going to make. I mean, that film has done very well. In the last 10 years, that film's made more money than any other film we've released. And it's an obvious sequel. They're detectives. They get another. So that's what we're going to make. Jeffrey wants to make it. We're going to make it. Whether you do it or not, we're going to make it. So he said, Hendel Butoy is also considering doing it. So would you mind working with him? I loved Hendel. I said, no, I love him. I'd be happy to. I said, let me think about it. What a bad answer. So I just said, let me think about it. I really don't love the idea. It's a sequel, but let me think about it, because I do. So anyway, I said, let me go have lunch with Hendel, and I'll tell you. I'll give you my answer after talking to Hendel. So I went to lunch with Hendel at Glendale, outside of the patio and out there. And we just started talking about the possibilities of the beautiful outback, the scope of the scale of the world is so gigantic in Australia, exotic. And, you know, frankly, I guess they picked Australia because Crocodile Dundee had come out. So, you know, Jeffrey always got excited by a hit, and he just thought, let me get a piece of that hit action. So, but it was a great, I love the animals that you have in Australia that are unique to that continent, you know, platypuses and, you know, kangaroo, just great. You've never seen Disney characters really from that realm. Very rarely would you see an Australian animal.
And the Aboriginal art.
Yeah, the Aboriginal art was so inspiring. But anyway, that's when we decided we loved the characters, Bernard and Bianca, and we loved the original. We loved it. So we had no problem with it. We just go, yeah, let's, and I don't want to turn down an opportunity I'm going to get like this. It may not come again. So I said, yeah, we'll do it. And I said, but we're going to go to Australia to research it. And Peter goes, no, you're not going. I go, Peter, we've never been to Australia. We're going to make a movie that takes place in Australia, but we're not going to go to Australia. No, you're not. Well, we're not going to send you to Australia. Forget it. Because that was never done. No one had ever done it before.
Right. The research trips were few and far between.
Yeah. I mean, you think the guys all went to London when they did 101 Dalmatians? No.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just, so it was just this kind of a crazy idea. We're going to send you to Australia. So anyway, I was absolutely determined to go. So I finally told him, like days later, I checked in maybe a week later, and he just goes, Mike, forget it. So I just said, well, I'm going. I'll pay my own way, but I'm going. I'm not going to make this movie without being at least exposed to the real continent. I want to know what I'm doing. I'm not going to fly blind through this whole thing. So he didn't say anything to that. He just, of course, you know, you'd think he'd go, oh, all right. No, he didn't say anything. But about a week later, Tom Schumacher, I think, was producer at the time on it. And Tom came back and said, Peter said, we're going to go to Australia. He said he'll pay his way. He'll pay the way. So
And that really sort of started the research trips after that, because any picture they were doing, you know, Lion King, the whole, you know, core team went to Africa.
We set up the paradigm, yeah.
Yeah, so.
From then on, it was always the way you did it.
Yeah.
It definitely impacted the film. I think the film shows, you know, extreme exaggerations of some things, but hell, I mean, just the opening shot is because we went to the middle of the continent and we climbed Ayers Rock, Uluru, and the Olgas, you know, that come flashing by. Those were actually mountains that we hiked through and felt the wind blowing through the canyons. And
it so, makes it more, it makes it more authentic.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think
that's what you're,
you know,
and yeah, authentic and separate from the other films. You know, you're always looking for what's going to make this film unique and not just be the same old thing. It's, you know, you can easily fall into, you know, let's say you got a dog or a cat or a Siamese, you got a couple of Siamese cats. What are you going to do to make it different than Siam? You know, you're always looking for a unique something that makes it really
yeah.
something.
The other interesting thing about Rescuers Down Under is that it marks the transition from the actual acetate cells that used to be painted yeah. to the computer technology, which yeah. of course Roy Disney was a huge proponent and supporter of, and really pushed Frank Wells to allocate the funding to do the digital technology, to bring digital technology into Disney animation. And so Rescuers Down Under really marks that delineation where the film is all digitally inked and painted. And how was that for you? Because that was really throwing in something completely new and different.
Yeah, it was totally. And for me, and I've been told recently, well, that's the first digital film ever made. So it's like any film of live action or animation, that's the first digital film ever put together, which is kind of cool. But it was exciting because the main thing is I would be told by Kathleen Gavin or Peter or Schneider, whoever, that you're going to get to use ink line, we're going to color the line, and you're going to get tone maps, and you're going to get... So I was just being told you're going to get all that sort of detail that Pinocchio had or Fantasia had, because we could never afford it with cells. It was too labor intensive, and the number of hours and artists, you know, 500 artists for 4 years to do Fantasia's one sequencer. So, you know, we weren't able to do, we will never even conceive of doing that, even though we kept screaming. Even Don Bluth was after the same thing. We want it to look like the old films, the quality of the old films. We don't want it to look like Aristocats anymore, or, you know, Robin Hood. Fantastic for the animation, but we still want to get into the worlds in more beautiful, exotic ways. So anyway, we were just thrilled to get the shot at doing something with tone mats and with shadows and, you know, just a beautiful return to the ink line look is what we were getting, you know, out of the deal. So I didn't know enough about computers to say, well, I don't think we're going to have the server space, or I think we're going to have to book a bunch of servers in Canada probably to store the digital information. I'm not that guy. I'm just going to say, ooh, I get to do more colors and more ink line and shadows, and give it to me, baby. So that, I mean, I could conceive of that opening shot. I still remember conceiving of the opening shot. And of course, that's only done with digital.
Which almost broke the system.
Yeah, it was brutal to the department to figure it out. But I was always told you're going to get a multi-plane camera, but times 10, you know, whatever you, as many layers, as it's going to be digitized. So you'll have as many layers as you want. What do I do? I come up with an idea where we got 15, you know, million layers, you know, as you're racing across the outback in the opening shot. I still remember pitching that.
And just so that the listeners understand, when we did cell animation, we were limited to 4 cell levels, because yeah. if you went beyond 4 cell levels, the actual cell started to shift the backgrounds and you started to get density issues. So you had to, even if you animated stuff on 10 different levels, it eventually all had to be boiled down to 4 cell levels. And they had the multiplane camera, which was also hugely labor intensive to use. So when on Rescuers Down Under, you literally could have 10,000 levels, because that is what they set it at, was 10,000. You could have 10,000 levels and you'd have no density issues, and you could do everything the multiplane camera could do and then some, you know. And you were correct in like having all those different ink lines and everything, but I distinctly remember them putting a cap on how many ink lines you could use. They started to manage it to like, okay, on this scene, you can only have 6 ink lines. So you pick the 6 you want, you know, do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. I was frustrated. Like, come on, we can do all, let's get, I was frustrated that we couldn't get more detail at incline work done. Yeah, we still had a little bit of a handcuff on some of that stuff. I can't complain at all. But I always remember going into color models to the ladies working on the computers for the first time, color models on a computer screen, and being told this is and she's, I don't say names, but this is the scene, here's the colors, and I'd go, those colors are different than the hookup scene to this. It's a different color. No, that's the same. I double checked, that's the same. I think it's different. I think it's darker. So anyway, we'd have the whole wall with those clipboards with just those folding pages, so she'd go flipping through the docket, just kind of the label of every shot and the color code, all just done by hand, so archaic. And she would go, oh, you're right. Yeah, that is different. Okay, I'll change it. But I mean, it was like, they'll tell you in color models, it was so much of just in my memory, what was a link to the, it's a different color. That's the different. It's a little bit different. I think that was because it was. So anyway, there was so much just like me coming out with a headache going, I hope I've caught everything. I hope I've caught everything. It wasn't like a digital, just a drop over. Nothing was loaded in that.
Right. And speaking of loaded in, I mean, that early cap system, they had to tell the digital technicians what scenes were going to be worked on the next day. And overnight, they would load the exabyte tape into this carousel essentially was the quote server, if you will, that could be worked on the next day. That's how, early the system was. And the graphics computers were actually Pixar computers. Pixar was involved with the design of that early cap system.
And we should make it, one of the coolest things about that whole transition was we kept all the ink and paint ladies from Walt's days, the ones that were there in at least the 50s, if not the 40s. And, they transitioned over and learned the computer coloring system.
They were initially very, very nervous when they were talking about a digital ink and paint system, because there was this nervousness that they were going to completely upend the back end of the production process and not really need most of those folks and bring in, software jocks and things like that. And it really was kind of interesting how they did that whole transition from the traditional method that had been done for 50 plus years at the Disney studios into the computer generation, computer generated imagery and compositing and all of that.
And now, Dave, you probably know more about this, but Kathleen Gavin said that she was the associate producer on it. And she said it was the only time she ever cried working on a film, where they said they were the tech guys, Lem
Davis and
but they came in and they promised that they could transition into a new, we were going to switch into a whole new delivery, technical digital delivery system and the film was going to come out in about 3 months, and they promised it could be backed out of if it didn't work. So she said, okay, go for it. You're sure I can stop it if it's not working? We stay with what we're at? Yes. Well, it didn't work. And so then they told her, it was like 3 months. She's got to deliver she's got like 6 weeks to deliver the whole film. And they said, we can't back out of it after all. And she just said, it's the only time she actually sat at her desk on a Sunday afternoon and cried.
Oh, wow.
I'm DED dead. We have no film now.
Yeah, so but it got done.
Yeah,
it got done. I mean, it was a miracle it got done, yeah. You know, because there were a lot of technical issues on the back end.
Those guys are heroes, yes.
But yeah, and they did go on to win a Technical Academy Award for the cap system because of it, you know. So
of course, the next year, yeah, for Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, just crazy stuff. But what are your fond memories of Rescuers Down Under as far as your first directing gig goes?
It's always one of my favorite memories is just working with Jeffrey. You have a Walt Disney figure that can green light anything you say or anything you do, and it just goes forward. So you don't have a committee, so you do have one voice you have to get an approval with. So I loved being able to call Jeffrey, like when Wilbur, the voice of Wilbur, who's the original guy? I forget his name, but the actor that played Wilbur from the first film, Orville from the first film. He was a great old character actor, but he had passed away, so we needed a new voice. So I came up with John Candy as a choice because I always loved John Candy. So I just called Jeffrey up and said, hey, I want to use John Candy for the brother of Orville, Wilbur, and for that role. And he just said, great, love it, do it, bang. So we just, that was that quick. And I pitched him the opening shot after we were having a story meeting, but we went to get coffee, and he and I were just standing there in the back of this little coffee kiosk area as I'm waiting for my coffee. I said, Jeffrey, I got an idea for the opening shot. And I said, it's kind of like in Hatari when it's all quiet at the beginning and you just hear these exotic sounds and everything's still. And then we break hard as we go. Instead of going after a rhino, we're just going to zoom across the outback. So we start at the mouse level, eye point of view, eye level, little bugs crawling around. And then we take off, bug takes off, and we zoom across the outback to Cody's house. So now we're at the adult, the human level. So we go from bug level to human level just to set up the two dynamics. Great, do it, love it. So that was the thing that became the big opening shot. But it was cool that you could just talk to a guy and get approval for that. And the research trip in Australia was so exotic and fun and wild. And I mean, I have great memories of being on that trip with Joe Ramsh, our head of story, and Pishut Dant,
yeah, excuse me.
So, and Hendel Butoy and Tom Schumacher, our producer. And so it was just such a small little group of five of us for 2.5 weeks over there, which was great fun. And honestly, the scoring sessions are so exciting. To that big score being done, I would be in the room out with the musicians and Hendel too. And just to hear that sort of, you know, the opening tracks and the way I really wanted those exotic instruments, because Hatari, I loved the way Henry Mancini used those exotic, weird sounding, you know, percussive instruments. So we did a lot of research with getting the didgeridoos and all that while we were in Australia, but mm-hmm. We brought back a bunch of those things. So, whoa, you know, just putting that there, just these, all these strange little timber, you know, contraption instruments. And I just love being on the stage when that would get put down and then run it with the imagery. Just that great feeling of
where was the score recorded? Do you recall?
Well, you would do each session in a different place. So some of it was Warner Brothers. Some of it was, and we would do some of the, we would do a lot of the vocal stuff on the lot on stage B, you know, and
yeah,
the old stage with Doc.
But the Clint Eastwood recording studio over at Warner Brothers is pretty yeah. great facility.
Talking about a legendary facility. Yeah. Yeah, we would do that. I think, but we'd even go to Sony. We'd go different. But a lot of it was at Eastwood's.
Yeah, that's a great stage.
So it was mainly that stuff. When it was, I mean, pitching the board, that one of the great memories is watching Glenn and Brenda Chapman Lima pitched the opening, the bird flight sequence with Cody, where Cody bonds with the eagle and flies with the eagle. And Chris Sanders actually boarded a lot of that stuff too. So top talent will make a pretty impactful moment in the film. So watching Brenda, you know, pitch her board with the eagle and the cuteness of that with the bird doing all its head stuff.
How did you like working with Bruce Broughton, the composer?
He was so nice and open to ideas, and he was just, he's one of the sweetest guys in the world. Again, just nice people.
And we had Bruce on the show a couple, 3 weeks ago or something.
Oh, great.
Yeah. We're just trying to grab people as we can, especially when there's anniversaries involved. But we talked a little bit with Bruce about the music for Rescuers Down Under, and also just music scoring in general for, you know, animated films.
He's done so much for the theme parks and all.
Oh,
and also, he always kind of liked that I had a yo-yo on the stage. So I was always doing a yo-yo, but the musicians would not let me yo-yo out. And cause I'm their Stradivariuses, and they're like watching me flip this yo-yo, this big wooden yo-yo around, and they finally kick me out and say, don't do the yo-yo, Mike. Don't do the yo-yo.
Oh boy. Great group of people.
Fun. The sound mix is so fun because you're putting all the elements together, and I would be sliding down the rugs in slippery shoes, and Bruce would start to do it too. We'd go running and slide down the theater slant, you know, and see who could slide the furthest. We had so much fun throughout it.
It's great stuff. The reception of the movie was reasonably good, I think.
Well, it was blasted. It was like a nuclear blast went off right next to the film release. That nuclear blast was Home Alone. So
yeah,
Home Alone came out. Everybody saw Home Alone. It was like all they saw was the big blast of Home Alone being so entertaining, so magical. And I love the film too. I think it's fantastic. So they're still entertaining. It's a classic, really. So nothing wrong with a film being great, but it just took all the wind out of our sails. So nobody was going to something called Rescuers Down Under. That just didn't appear. There wasn't something didn't click in their, and their excitement level. They weren't intrigued by that title, and the original film hadn't been out. Well, I take it back. They released it. So it was just one of those moments where one film was the one they wanted to see, because it gave you everything you wanted in a Christmas film, comedy, and that Macaulay Culkin was adorable. Yeah. But yeah, so that was the only downside was it was definitely considered a failed release.
Partly because Jeffrey had pulled the television advertising.
He pulled it on the first Saturday morning. Yeah. He pulled it all. He said, it's not working. We're pulling it. So it did die quick, and I kept, he gave me the phone call at 7:30 in the morning on the first day of release, on the second day of release on Saturday morning. And he just said, no, it's not working, Mike. They're all going to Home Alone. Forget it. It's over. Think about the next one. Just move on. He didn't blame me, or it wasn't anything we did wrong. Just said it's not working. So we're pulling the press, pulling everything.
You know, that's one of the.
What about word of mouth, Jeffrey? Word of mouth. The word of mouth.
You know, that's what
I said. He's just like, move on, forget it, move on.
Yeah, but they were so quick to do that. That's the thing that bothered me, was that they, like, at any sign that there was a little bit of a speed bump, they would just yank, advertising. We're not putting any more money to it. And you're like, wait a second. You know, there's a movie here and it could have legs,
Well, I don't think Eisner really he didn't really care for the movie much, I think. In his autobiography, he said something like, it was the only creative miss in my first 10 years, something like that. But he didn't say financially, he said creative, which kind of like a little bit of a dagger in the heart, But they let me direct again, I did enough Pocahontas after that.
Yeah. So, when did you pitch Pocahontas? I think we can take a few more minutes and go into this, because I think this is a really interesting story, because you just explain to our audience what the Gong Show was and then what your pitch was. Because as I remember it, you had a piece of art and you had one word. You said Walt Disney Pictures Presents, but essentially one word title, but go ahead.
That's how Peter Schneider remembers it too, but I actually had on the back of it. So anyway, I'll just set it up. So they decided, Jeffrey, the films were starting to work. Little Mermaid had come out and they needed movies. They wanted some great movies to be made. So where do we get the ideas? So they turned it over to the animation department and said, anybody that has any ideas for a feature film, you can pitch it to Michael Eisner, Jeffrey Katzenberg, Roy Disney, and Peter Schneider. And they'll give you an immediate yes or no, or they will either gong it or give it some love. So if you want to get a film made, you don't get to direct it necessarily, but if you have an idea you want Walt Disney Studios to make, here's your moment. come to the Gong Show Thursday at 3 o'clock in this meeting room and just pitch your, you got as much time as you want, but pitch your story. So this was around Thanksgiving time, and I had failed getting the audience to care about Rescuers Down Under because they didn't recognize it as one of those great titles. You know, Little Mermaid was such a huge success with the music, the sweep, the beauty, the title, Hans Christian Andersen's Little Mermaid. So it's a title that says classic. So I'm thinking, man, I need a title that's like Pinocchio or one of those titles that people recognize and get excited about. Oh, it's, you know, the little match girl, whatever it is. So I'm looking for a title, really. So I'm at my, and I'm determined to make it a musical made this time. I want music in this next movie. I want songs that people resonate with because they just move you emotionally. And they're such a big part of the fun animation with music. So I knew I wanted a title and I wanted music. And I really wanted to do a Western of some sort. So I'm looking for something like, you know, something sort of Westernish. So I'm at my wife Tammy's relative's house for Thanksgiving, her aunt and uncle's house. And as they're in the kitchen getting the dinner ready, I'm just all by myself in the uncle's library. And he had a pretty extensive bunch of books in the bookcase. And so I saw a lot of titles, you know, like Ivanhoe, and he had the classics in there, Tom Sawyer and all that stuff. But then I saw Pocahontas and I immediately went, bing, 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 bing. Go, whoa, I love the idea. She's American Indian. I love the idea. All I know is she put her head on John Smith and saved the guy's life. So she saved the guy's life rather than the hero being the man. She's the heroine. I go, oh man, and she's a princess. Her dad is a chief. I go, whoa, she's a princess. And then there's all the magic of the animism and all the belief system and all the animals of the forest and all, blah, blah, blah. Just like, and the music is going to have all the drums. And I'm going, this is it. This is it. So I went into the kitchen. I said, I just thought of the next big Disney feature.
It's amazing.
Such a meek little humble man I am. And they all go, kind of laugh, but they go, yeah, what is it? I go, Walt Disney's Pocahontas. And they all just go, that's a great idea, actually. That is really good. I love that. So I go, yeah, we can do the magic and the special effect. And we'll have all this, you know, great animals that can talk. And so anyway, because that's what Native Americans believe. You can speak with the animals. And it's just like a natural for Disney. It's never been touched. And she's the princess, but she saves the prince. And it's all just so, it's I'm so excited about. So anyway, when the Gong Show came up, I'm like, bang, I'm going to pitch Pocahontas. So that night, I just thought, I'm just going to get up and say Pocahontas. I got to say something. So I structured what the story really, what the beauty of the structure is. I wrote it out and I taped it to the back of the art. I take the wording down real simple, a paragraph about a Native American princess falls in love with the invading settlers and is torn between her father's wishes to destroy the settlers and her wishes to bring peace. As you know, and I think I might've said something about the love story of John Smith, but she fell in love with one of the settlers, something like that. So it's a love story set in this world of two clashing cultures coming together by this invading, you know, incoming group. So I just thought, you know, because the title is so good, Walt Disney's Pocahontas, I love that. I got to get the poster. So I quickly did up, this is like the night before, I mocked up a poster that was probably about 18 by 24. And I Xeroxed Walt Disney's, you know, scripted, and I taped together the real Walt Disney logo. And then I mocked in my own Pocahontas. And then I put like Tiger Lily in the forest with little forest animals. And I colored it in. I made the whole color scene in the forest. And I, you know, little ship in the background coming in maybe. So here's the one sheet. So anyway, when I got, and I have a sheet of paper over it. So when the, okay, Mike, what's your idea? I'm at the Gong Show and there's Michael and Roy and Jeffrey. And all right, what do you got? And I'd already directed, so they knew I was a director, but what do you got? So I just go, I pull the sheet back and I show the one sheet across this huge table. I mean, it was such a long table. And I hold the one sheet up and I read the back. When all they heard was Walt Disney's, I just said, Walt Disney's Pocahontas. An Indian princess falls in love with a settler of the invading government. And I read the thing off and I put the thing down and they just look at each other. It went quiet. The whole room went quiet. And they just go, wow, that's good. And Michael says to Jeffrey, I mean, Michael honestly said, didn't we make that already? But that's how natural it was, I guess. But he goes, no, that's Pinocchio. It's Pocahontas. Something like that. I mean, I shouldn't say that. But I was told never repeat that story. But anyway, he thought I was a pretty good failure. So. Anyway, I love Michael. I cute Michael. But anyway, I said, Walt Disney's Pocahontas. And then they looked at each other and they just said, hey, Michael said to Jeffrey, hey, that's your Romeo and Juliet. That's the clash of the cultures. Perfect. It's in a new setting in the wild and it's got all the animals in it. You go, that's good. That's really good. Yeah, Mike, that's great. We can do this. We can do that. And now they're just talking to each other. Then we can do this and the music can be that. Blah, blah. So anyway, it wasn't like that's a great one, but it ended with everybody just going, wow, that's a good idea. Everyone goes, that's a good idea. So anyway, when we walked out of the meeting, everybody had pitched, you know, probably 10 different pitch items. And I remember people just like, man, Mike, yours went really well. That sure went well. And then the next day I got a phone call from Jeffrey. He was on his private jet going to New York and he just called me and said, Mike, it's a green light. We're going to make it. Go start developing it. So I got the official green light the next day.
That's awesome. That is amazing. that's such a great story. But, you know, it really is the story that floats around is that Mike just said, Walt Disney Pictures presents Pocahontas. Like, that was his pitch.
Mic drop.
Well, it's a good selling point because anybody would think, well, I can do that. All I got to do is think of the title.
Yeah, that's the way Orion Pictures, you know, back in the day when they were selling all these movies, they would have the artist come up with like the movie poster and pitch it to these executives.
Is that right?
Yeah. And that's how a lot of the Stallone movies were sold just on the basis of, you know, Stallone in, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, when you were just describing that, Mike, I was sold. I was like, I was thinking the exact same thing. I was rolling. It's like, oh man, this is going to be great. It's the whole Romeo and Juliet thing. My brain was working. I was in the room. I felt like I was in the room with you making the pitch. And I was like, I am not gonging this. This is amazing. And of course it was amazing.
It did. That one did land nicely. So good. Yeah, I'm really proud of the success of that. And even Rescue, you know, it was such a hard release for Rescues for me. I mean, Dave, in hindsight, it doesn't seem that bad, but it was a pretty good blow to me. Just my heart was into it so fully. But over time, I've been shocked at the number of people that have been great, huge fans of that film, even more than Pocahontas. Like I went to we went to lunch with some of the guys up at Lucasfilm and special effects and like the top guys in the industry, and we're having lunch outside in San Francisco with them, and they didn't know me from Adam. It might be a real name, no connection of any kind, obviously. And then, but then they go, after the lunch is almost done, word gets around, hey, this is the guy that did Rescuers Down Under. And they go telling each other, hey, Jim, this guy directed Rescuers Down Under. No way. Oh my God. We love that film. Yeah. It, that kind of reaction now and then from top guys in the industry. And I'm just like, well, something got through, something really connected with people.
You know, I think though that, you know, you can't judge these movies just by a box office.
I mean, look at Pinocchio. That was a failure when it came out, honestly.
Exactly. You know, Pinocchio didn't do well. Fantasia didn't do well. You know, these are great films. I mean, these are at the pinnacle of the art form, you know. And so to me, I'm not surprised people, have warmed up, if you will, or that there's a cult following or however you want to put it. You know, Nightmare Before Christmas. There's a contemporary film. Well, when it went out, because they didn't know how to market it. And again, you know, Rescuers Down Under, they just pulled the advertising on it, so nobody knew about it. And I think if they had just let the advertising play out for another couple of weeks, it would, people who had seen Home Alone would have said, okay, let's go see Rescuers Down Under, you know. And
the timing of the release, you know, the public, the worldwide public was positioned by Little Mermaid. They can't wait for the next musical, special musical from Disney. So they wanted that Little Mermaid feeling again. Yeah. This was none of that. This was actually a little rough. I looked at it again recently for the anniversary. And it is a pretty intense, you know, there's a lot of intensity to McLeach. And I think his character works and he's really funny. And Joanna, there's a lot of great characters in the film throughout, really good characters. Yeah. But it's pretty intense, throwing knives and dipping them in Crocodile Falls. And I mean, I was young and maybe didn't quite I went for it pretty strong. You know, I'd rather, I guess that's my nature, is I go a little more intense, and I'd rather have something visceral and a little more intense, you know, just to keep the thing, as powerful as it can be. Maybe I could have tempered it a little more.
Well, hey, listen, that's what makes it memorable.
I have very fond memories of working on the film, and I enjoy it. I watch all of these movies from time to time. You know, I'll pop one of them on, and you know, I think Rescuers Down Under holds up really well.
I like hearing that.
Overall, as a film, and I do think that there's an audience out there that really enjoys it. I wish we could continue talking, because we could probably talk for another, multiple hours here. You know, 2, 3, 4 hours, just drilling into every one of these projects. But I do want to say thanks for having, you know, thanks for you coming on the show. But I definitely want to see us have you back as a guest again in the future. And I want to talk more about the latter part of your career, because I think you've done some magnificent stuff as a production designer. I mean, look at Wreck-It Ralph. I mean, holy mackerel, you know, I mean, such a great film and a beautiful looking film. All those different environments and stuff. Yeah. So,
I'd love to talk about it. I love that film. It's one of my most proudest films I've worked on. Yeah.
Awesome. And we should give a shout out if anybody's interested. Mike Gabriel has a store on Etsy with a lot of his beautiful artwork. Some of it, I think, was inspired. There's some paintings that I think are inspired by your work on Moana. Am I correct?
Trust me, I didn't work on Moana, but I would have loved to have. I've always loved the tiki aspect, you know, the Pacific Island sort of world of, you know, we go to Hawaii every year. And so I have a special take on that, where it's not culturally popular to be this way, not right now, but I don't care. I'm true to who I am. And my relationship with the island is a vacation, you know? So I love the legacy of sort of that, the dream world kind of way of doing the island stuff. So I love the people and the culture and the fabric and the senses, the flavor. So I put my artwork to that experience that I wish for the islands to continue, and not just become, not try to prove I can get down to the real grit truth of the betrayal of the islands to the white culture. And I accept that as where anyone comes from, and they want to communicate that. I'm communicating sort of the fantasy element of the white man's vacation. I put a simplicity to it, and just the beauty of the feel of the wind. All my characters have wind blowing through their hair, and the smells of the ocean. And so I try to capture that. But I came up with this idea of putting glamour as a part of it. So I love the George Harrell Hollywood glamour, or the beauty of 1930s perfect lighting and glamour of the pose, and you know, whether it's these famous actresses or I get inspired by those elements. And so I thought, I was trying to figure, what am I going to paint next, the Hawaiian thing or this? I want to do some of these glamour shots. And I go, wait a minute, nobody's ever put glamour to the Hollywood, the beauty of the Hollywood female form. And I mean, it was to the beauty of the Hawaiian female form. So I'm just going to put these beautiful elegance to the, like a sort of a non sequitur elegance to their culture. And I think it's going to bring something really unique that is like, you can see it as a way of portraying the influence of white man onto the island by it being kind of the Hollywood glamour aspect of it. But I see it any way you want. It's what I think looks real. It's a new way of looking at Hollywood, of Hawaiian culture through a glamour Hollywood lens, you know? And I think it's just fun to see what I can do with that to make it feel fantasy-like, you know. I'm always about the fantasy.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
I've never been drawn to the real, true grit of real life. I've always wanted to go into sort of a make-believe land. So I'm making it into a make-believe land. So it wouldn't, it rubbed some people maybe as culturally not proper or not true to the culture. I'm coming at it, as an artist, I'm creating what Mike Gabriel has created. So
I got to say, people go to Mike's Etsy store, look at his prints. They're absolutely stunning, his paintings. Yes. I love Mike's artwork. I own some of Mike's artwork.
Yeah.
Not only do I have the Lorenzo the cat hanging on the wall here, but I also have one of your Hawaiian women paintings.
Fantastic.
You donated it a number of years ago to a charity art and wine auction that we were doing, and Nancy and I actually bought that one.
I have
one of those paintings as well. I have this whole collection of artwork, Aljana.
All
my friends who are just fantastic painters, I've seemed to have acquired some of their work over the years, either as a gift or through a purchase. So
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
But it's an honor to have a man like you and your taste. In your house is an honor.
It's beautiful stuff. That. And by the way, beautiful stuff, Mike. You know, when I look at your art, it reminds me of covers of Harper's Bazaar, because it's got that look and very classy, elegant, you know, as you said, that whole beautiful kind of vibe. That. So, you know, I'm looking at that going, man, that could be, you know, the front of a Harper's Bazaar magazine. It just looks really, really great. And also being, you know, Filipino Chinese, I think it is a really great, I think it's just beautiful. Beautiful art is beautiful art, regardless.
It's a celebration. It's a celebration of culture.
That's the byline. I'm going to put that. Beautiful art is beautiful art.
That's
right.
It.
Yeah, that's right. Because there's a sincerity to it. You can tell, right? Aljan?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's
a beautiful art. It's beautiful art. It's great form. And it is very just visually just stunning, very beautiful. And by the way, big fan of the art of the animals that you have there too, because
a lot of animals there.
There's so many. Once again, it's just so much personality in the art. And one of these days, I too will have Mike Gabriel art in my home. So it'll be amazing. So,
all right, Mike. Thank you. Thank you so much for being on, folks. Go visit Mike's Etsy store, Mike Gabriel at Etsy. And Mike, we're going to look forward to having you back on the show at some point in the future. When things are better, when we're through this pandemic, maybe you and your brother Tom and I will go grab a beer someplace.
Yeah.
Now that you're retired with the rest of us.
I would love it, Dave. Yeah, we got to do it. We got to go to Paris on Burbank Boulevard.
Wishing you and your family a very happy new year, and we will see you soon in the new year once we get through this whole pandemic.
Yes. Sounds good. Love it. Thanks, guys, for having me. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and I hope to see you soon.
Thanks, Mike.
More to come.
Your attention, please. Now loading on track number one. For a trip around Walt Disney's Magic Kingdom.
Skull Rock Podcast.
All aboard.
Your main street to the world of Disney.
Wow. What a great, great storyteller. You're right. You're right, Dave. Mike is awesome.
He really is, you know. He's really an incredible artist, and I have to tell you, I think it's so inspirational when he talks about how he got his job at Disney. I mean, to me, anybody who's just starting out in animation today really needs to listen to that story because it's inspiring. It's a great example of somebody not giving up, not being discouraged by being turned down or, you know, being given feedback, but who's actually taking those moments and gleaning the positive information from it and going off and listening to that information and improving and drawing and doing the work that was asked for and eventually getting hired at Disney and having this incredibly illustrious, really illustrious 41 year career. I mean, incredible. It was so great talking to him. I had so many memories flashback of a lot of these projects, you know, because I worked in the effects department on Rescuers Down Under. And, you know, I had so much fun working on some of these pictures. So it's always great to bring these guests on. And Mike is, like I said, what a great storyteller.
I love it. And I'm so happy I was there to help document it and be there for those questions, for those answers, because, well, amazing stories indeed. I love it.
Well, I think that's it. I mean, we are barreling to the end of 2020 and yes. good riddance to this year. I think every one of us wants this to, just to be over and get 2021 going because it's gonna be, it can only get better, Al John.
That's what I'm saying.
We can only go up from here.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. So thank you for that, Dave. It's been a great year for us in this very first few months of kicking off this show, Skull Rock Podcast. So thank you for having me be part of it. And I'd like to thank our listeners for coming along for the ride. We're getting bigger and better every single week, and that's all because of you and your support. So thank you so much. But I encourage everybody, if you're a fan of our show, Disney and Pop Culture, please subscribe to the show. I know you may have just stumbled upon us, but we would love for you to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and give us a like, a follow, and maybe even a review. That would be certainly helpful, especially on platforms like iTunes. That would be great. You can also follow us on, once again, all our social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And be sure to email us as well, Aljon, A-L-J-O-N, at Skull Rock Podcast, or Dave at skullrockpodcast.com. And as we ring out this year and we look forward to the new year, Dave, do you have any final words?
Well, I'm not ringing out this old year. I am kicking this old year out the door. That's all I can say. I want to wish everybody a happy and safe and healthy new year. Celebrate safely, please. Let's get this pandemic behind us. And Aljon, I hope you and Kristen and the kids have a wonderful New Year celebration at home. Nancy and I are going to watch the ball drop in Times Square on television at 9 o'clock Pacific time, midnight Eastern time. And we're going to pop a bottle of champagne, have a couple glasses of champagne, and just sit in our warm, cozy home in our little bubble, free of virus.
Same here. And by the way, please send our wishes to your mom celebrating her 90th. That's an amazing milestone.
I will. I'm going to be posting something later this week on social media with some pictures of my mom. I think that people, when they look at a picture that I have of her from a year ago, they're going to be flawed, really flawed.
That's awesome.
By the fact that she's turning 90, because she doesn't look it, I'll tell you that.
Well, you're as only as young as you feel, right? And so happy birthday, Mom. I appreciate that. And thank you all for listening to us here on Skull Rock Podcast. Have a happy and safe New Year.
Happy New Year.
I'm Aljon Goh, co-host of the Disney List podcast as heard on Sorcerer Radio, as well as Skull Rock Podcast, here with my wife, Kristen. Hello.
Hello.
You are an earmarked agent who books Disney travel vacations for people all the time. Give our listeners a reason why they'd want to give you a call instead of just booking a trip by themselves.
Well, I can do all of the legwork for them. I have expertise. I've been to the Disney parks well over 100 times, so they've got that knowledge at their hand, as well as it saves them time and money.
Where can people get in touch with you so that they can book their next Disney cruise, Disney park trip, Adventures by Disney?
They can contact me at themeparksandcruises@gmail.com. I'm Kristen Hetzel, vacation planner, world traveler, Disney foodie, and theme park fan.
I'm Aljon Goh. I'm the husband who's also Disney, Star Wars, and Marvel Comics fan. And together, we host a Disney List podcast.
Every week, you'll hear us list our favorite things about Disney theme parks, films, shows, travel, Marvel, and Star Wars in a top 10 list, rankings, and more.
That's an impressive list. Subscribe to the Disney List podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, or your favorite podcast platform. Even stream us on Sorcerer Radio at srsounds.com and check out our live shows on Facebook, The Disney List Podcast. Visit thedisneylist.com.